This is Sustainable East End, show about land use, energy and water resources, transportation, and the farming and food industries on the East End of Long Island. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, co-producer with Tony Ernst. What are coastal communities planning to do in the face of rising sea levels? One town that's grappling with that issue is East Hampton, New York. On May 16th, the town held the first of three planned public meetings to discuss and get feedback about erosion risks and storm vulnerability to the community. It's all part of the town's Coastal Assessment Resiliency Plan. I sat down several days before the meeting with Peter Van Skoyek. He's Deputy Town Supervisor and a member of East Hampton's Coastal Assessment and Resiliency Planning Committee. We talked about the plan, which is about adapting to climate change, but we also discussed some mitigation efforts, including the controversial wind project in the works off the shore of Montauk, and what residents can do to get help in cutting their energy use. Peter Van Skoyek, welcome to Sustainable East End.
Thank you so much for having me, Francesca.
Now, East Hampton, New York, received a little over $400,000 several years ago to do coastal resiliency. Why don't you tell us the name of what the town received the grants for and the program?
So we received two grants. One was from the Department of State and the other was through NYSERDA. We have a coastal resiliency assessment and resiliency planning study, which is underway, which is a Department of State grant, and that was for a little over $250,000. The total amount of grants is $435,000. There's also another study that's underway, which is, we call it the Dewberry Grant. They won the award, and basically it's looking at historic rates of erosion and sediment transport throughout our coastal regions and within the town. These two studies combined will help policymakers chart a path forward to deal with rising sea level and increasingly virulent storms.
Now, there are two parts to this plan, is that right? One that has to do with assessment, the other has to do with response in the case of extreme weather?
Right, we're right now in the assessment stages of the studies, and so we're going in through the CARP study parcel by parcel in areas that are at risk within the town. We have a number of hot spots throughout the town, low-lying coastal areas, of which downtown Montauk, for instance, is one. So we're looking parcel by parcel at scenarios for different amounts of sea level rise and inundation due to storm surge, to do an assessment as to what areas will not be sustainable within certain scenarios and over certain periods of time, so that we can decide how we need to adapt in order to keep our economic engines going. We're a coastal community. We rely heavily upon our beaches. That is a major driver for our economy. And we have a number of areas where we have infrastructure at risk to rising sea level or to hurricanes. So being able to know what we might expect under these various scenarios will help long-term planning.
And projections as to sea level rise, these are changing all the time, it seems. Where are you getting this data from?
Well, it's coming from several sources. New York State itself has adopted coastal sea level rise predictions. Essentially, there's a worst case scenario number that they've adopted, which is roughly 6.5 feet by 2100. So you can imagine 6.5 feet of sea level rise with a 10 or 12 foot storm surge, and you're approaching 18 feet above sea level that we experience today. It's very difficult to know, because the rise levels are being reassessed and increased regularly, to know exactly what we should be planning for. But essentially, we've gone through, the consultants have gone through and recommended a moderate and then a worst case, so that we can try both those scenarios within that model. They have a computer modeling software program they've developed. It's called COAST. and that allows for different scenarios to be played out on a geographic map, and you can see which areas are inundated and to what degree, so that you can make longer-term planning decisions.
Now, I recently saw that under an extreme scenario, which would be the West Antarctic ice sheet melting, that we could be seeing 12 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century. I've even seen other assessments that talk about 3 meters, which is 21 feet. So I say this not to say that those are the ones, but how does one plan for this kind of change as a town? How does one plan for the potential for even more serious sea level rise in doing this kind of assessment? Is there any way to adjust upward?
Well, there is, and I think just by virtue of the fact that we have these modeling programs where we can input the data as it changes, then we'll obviously be able to look at different scenarios. Currently we're planning based on a little more conservative sea level rise than you're speaking to. I think the process is going to be similar in terms of trying to identify higher ground and adapting to keep our communities as intact as possible and make those transitions, over the longer period of time, rather than having to be reactive, having to be, in the position of dealing with a major catastrophe that could, cripple our communities.
So what are the major challenges that you're facing in developing a response?
Well, I think, the primary challenge is to engage the public in a discussion and chart a path forward that the public accepts. And, I'm very heartened to see this past year when we had our hamlet studies underway and we had charrettes in various communities, hamlets within the town, to see that a large number of the public are already changing the mindset to understand that, sea level rise and more virulent storms are a serious threat. And in terms of longer term planning, are taking those into consideration. So I think, the discussion still needs to be had. What are vital resources? What's vital infrastructure? What are vital parts of our economy that we need to protect and prepare to adapt for to make sure they can continue?
And what are the resources? You've gotten these grants to do these studies. Has there been any promise or a sense that at least there will be a response from the state and even the federal government once the assessment has been made?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. I think there's a great deal of awareness now, much more so than in the past, that these issues are real. The state setting standards, a sea level rise standard, is encouraging. As far as our planning, I think ideally we want to try and protect our coastlines now to the extent we can. But I think we have to be able to plan to move forward, as I said before, to adjust zoning, for instance.
Could you say more about what that means?
So, for instance, if you have vital parts of your community, economic generators, that will be inundated and cannot be sustained in their current locations, then you have to look, and the community decides these are important to the community. There would need to be rezoning to allow these various sectors of the community to be rebuilt in locations where maybe currently they're not allowed to be built under zoning.
So you're talking about withdrawing from the edge of the coastline?
Well, I think, in some scenarios and cases, some places, that there's no choice. We'll be inundated. We know that there are low-lying areas now, which, if we had a major hurricane, would be wiped clean.
Such as?
Well, we have areas, for instance, in Lazy Point, and we have, we've actually received close to $10 million from the Department of Agriculture to do buyouts of properties in that area. And we've had a number of property owners who are willing to, sell that property. And these properties are going to be restored to be wild areas again. As sea level rises, they're areas that can become marshland and wetlands. Currently, they're dry, but we have nor'easters, and they tend to get flooded. More mild hurricanes, they tend to get flooded.
Girard Drive might be another one.
Girard Drive is another area where the town has been active, actually, in acquiring properties.
What are the valuations based on for those properties? Because one could imagine a scenario where sea level rise becomes more evident, that it's going to be difficult to get insurance, property values may go down. How is the town responding to the issue of the value of the properties it may want to be able to take back?
Well, insurance obviously is something, the ability to get insurance for a coastal property is an important part of the equation. It basically bolsters the value of the property. If a person couldn't get that insurance, they might be less likely to make that type of investment in an area at risk. So that, you know, that does affect property value. The town pays the market rate for properties when we acquire them, and it's through a willing seller program.
So does that mean it might be smarter for somebody to sell to the town sooner rather than later?
Well, I think some people are making that calculation, actually, and are selling for those reasons.
You're listening to Sustainable East End, and we're talking with Peter Van Skoyek. He's the East Hampton Town Deputy Supervisor. So there's been an issue out in Montauk of how to respond to storm surge and sea level rise. There's been a fair amount of controversy over the installation of these enormous geotextile bags that were put in by the Army Corps of Engineers. It was backed up by the town to do that. Now they've been washed away at least once, possibly twice. Well, the sand that's covering them has washed them away. Now the town is going to become responsible for maintaining them. What's your perspective on this issue? And is this something that the town really should be taking on if it's going to be an expense that's going to be happening over and over again?
Well, I think the strategy of the town has been to do short-term stabilization. And we took on that project. The Army Corps first approached the town wanting to place a rock revetment or a steel sheet metal wall. The current town board felt neither that those was the correct way to go, and they offered no sand-only replenishment because it didn't meet their cost-benefit analysis. And so we were basically left with doing nothing or taking on a geobag artificial dune covered with sand and planted with beach grass in front of a row of approximately 13 motels in the downtown. Post-Sandy, we saw a great deal of loss of the beach there and foundations damaged and exposed. In major nor'easters, their portions of that stretch had foundations exposed with the waves, crashing directly against the vertical concrete walls. And, you know, we felt it just wasn't prudent to do nothing. So we took on a short-term intermediate stabilization project, as I described with the Corps. It's been installed. Primarily the problem that we're having in Montauk is the fact that the natural dune line was built on years ago. And there's an intertidal zone that, depending on season, either accretes sand or it erodes sand. In the wintertime, it tends to erode severely at a couple of locations. In a natural, unimpeded situation, those dunes that have stored up sand all summer tend to release that sand and keep a beach, a fairly wide beach, although there may be steep, scarp banks as a result of that erosion. And then when the winds come around the southwest in the summertime, the sand tends to move back up on the beach and create and widen the beach. So having a built environment within that zone doesn't allow for those seasonal fluctuations. So longer term, when we first discussed doing the stabilization project, the Army Corps has this ongoing Fire Island to Montauk project, which is a reformulation study that is now funded by Congress post Sandy to the tune of about $750 million that money is appropriated to do beach replenishments and other coastal erosion projects. The FIM project for Montauk would be a sand-only beach replenishment. So coupled with the short-term stabilization followed by a large-scale sand-only beach replenishment, we felt that this would allow the greatest protection for downtown Montauk for the shortest period of time and the least expense. Mm-hmm. I think stage three is, which we've already undertaken with CARP, is to do an assessment of the long term and start making plans to make adaptations to alleviate these threats, either by relocating, reinforcing. And when I say reinforcing, in some cases, we can identify areas where buildings could be raised up, vital infrastructure could be fortified. You know, we have some utilities that are at risk. Actually, PSEG has already started raising some of the substations on the island. So, you know, it's basically a three-prong approach: stabilization, replenishment, and resiliency planning.
Now, another critical issue, and one that is not unrelated to the issue of sea level rise, is water quality. I mean, there are areas and ways in which it's not related, that is overdevelopment and inadequate sewerage. So I'd like you to address that too. But also, let's just start with talking about what might be some threats to the water supply under sea level rise.
Well, I think most of our well fields for public water are mostly out of harm's way. However, we already know in some of our lower-lying coastal areas, and you mentioned Girard Drive earlier, until public water mains were installed, private wells became, you know, polluted with an intrusion of salt water. If you have a narrow freshwater lens, you can actually pump all the water out, or at least enough of it for intrusion from the bay or the creek or whatever salt water is nearby. So that risk increases for coastal properties that are low-lying and have private wells.
So as you go forward, first of all, I believe there's going to be the first public meeting of the Coastal Assessment Resiliency Plan public forum. Tell us about that and what you hope to have accomplished there.
The GEI Consultants Incorporated will be presenting an examination of the coastal erosion risks and storm vulnerability within the community. They'll be showing us actual maps of inundation zones under various scenarios. And basically, it will be a presentation and discussion which will break up into smaller groups so that people there can participate in small table discussions about what they've learned at the meeting. And also it's to inform the public of the process of the resiliency planning. So CARP is undertaking the study, and there's an assessment portion, and then there's the resiliency planning portion, and we are going to engage the public directly in that latter discussion. So I think there'll be a lot of opportunity for members of the public to understand what's being discovered and to interact with public officials and their fellow citizens about a path forward.
You're listening to Sustainable East End on WPKN. We're talking with East Hampton Town Supervisor Peter Van Skoyek. The town has been fairly innovative and forward-thinking in taking on this kind of assessment project and the response to it. East Hampton is, I believe, just one of the first municipalities in the United States, the other one being San Francisco, that said it was going to be fueled by renewable energy entirely, 100% by 2020. What are the roles of the town, the state, and the federal government in addressing these? What are the roles and resources they can bring to bear?
Well, here locally in East Hampton, we've pressed a number of initiatives to both improve efficiency in energy consumption, as well as looking for renewable sources and setting a very, very high bar. And I really believe that that's, the groundbreaking for us to have made such a high and lofty goal to reach renewables by 2020 and other fuel sources by 2030. Where we have actually an RFP out now to start replacing some of our vehicle fleet with electric vehicles where that's practical. And we've had a home energy rating system so that all new homes built have to meet a higher standard of energy efficiency. And houses over a certain size, 4,500 square feet, have to meet a much higher standard. So in many cases, in order to meet certification, they have to generate electricity on site by installing solar panels in order to offset their energy usage.
But that's what the town can do for mitigation. It's wonderful, but it's small because it's just one town within a whole global environment. It seems to me the town is doing everything that it can, but what can the state do? What can the federal government do to actually move not just the town offices into a renewable future, but everybody who lives within it?
Well, I will say that the state has had a very aggressive program as of late, and we're the beneficiaries of some of the grant funding that they've offered. I mentioned that that we currently have an RFP out for electric-powered vehicles, and that's going to be made possible through a $100,000 grant we'll be receiving from NYSERDA as being considered a clean climate community. In other words, we've done enough towards increasing efficiency that we qualify under the state program. So they're incentivizing communities to become clean energy communities, making grant funding available. For instance, we're updating a lot of lighting within various town buildings to LED lighting to lower our energy consumption. We've done benchmarking of energy usage for all town buildings over 1,000 square feet. So that we know what our energy consumption is for each location, and we'll be reducing it over time through various initiatives.
And that's great. But what kind of help can there be for homeowners to actually follow in the town's footsteps?
So it's important to know that the largest energy consumer is one's house. And one of the ways that you can lower your electric bills is to have your house energy audit done. And that's done free. And that's another program that's through the state, also supported by the town.
I just had that done, as a matter of fact. But once they do the audit, there's really very little help. They'll change some light bulbs for you if you're under a certain income. But other than that, there's really no help for homeowners. Maybe people who are quite wealthy can do whatever they want, but for the bulk of homeowners, it might be quite difficult. Do you think that there are ways in which the state and the federal government can actually help whole communities to go renewable?
Well, we would certainly hope that tax credits would continue to be made available. There are substantial tax credits for solar roof installations for a private home. The turnaround time for payback of those costs is 5 to 6 years now. So that's really quite a short turnaround time. That turnaround time, the cost has come down over the years. And then essentially, in many cases, you're paying almost nothing in an electric bill. So the savings to the individual are huge. I mentioned the home energy audit. Most of the time, making those small improvements through insulation and changing light bulbs and all that sort of thing more than pays for itself in within a 2-year time. And that will continue to give individuals savings, substantial savings.
What do you think would be the single most important thing that the state of New York could do and the federal government could do to help the town of East Hampton become a more resilient coastal community?
Well, I think part of what New York State has done is that they have recognized that offshore wind is a very viable source for clean, renewable energy. We are benefited by the fact that this is an area of the coastline that is at the very highest level of wind generation potential. And, you know, I know that there are large lease areas both in New York State waters. And interestingly enough, even oil and gas companies are purchasing leases for offshore wind. The Danish oil and gas has several. Statoil from Norway. And then we have Deepwater Wind right here over in Rhode Island waters, which is planning a 90-megawatt wind farm that would benefit the residents of East Hampton directly. You know, I know there's concern among the fishing industry about potential impacts, and we've certainly urged Deepwater, and they've been very willing to discuss directly with the fishing industry about potential impacts and mitigating them. So they're more than willing to have an open dialogue. I think it's important to know that the clean, renewable energy is something we have to switch to. We have many, many freshwater bodies in the state of New York and all up through New England that are contaminated with mercury. Fish are not at safe eating levels anymore due to the fact that we've had this pollution from fossil-fired plants in the Midwest, and the fallout of that through acid rain has contaminated our waters, and it'll be decades before I think you know, the mercury levels get down to what's considered safe eating levels on a regular basis, and that's freshwater fish. Fossil fuels burning contributes to ocean acidification, makes it very difficult for sea creatures to form shells, mollusks, for instance, and you know, all of these impacts over time. You know, rising water temperatures creates more algal blooms. We've had fish kills in the bay this past year, due to mahogany tide, which is an algal bloom. It's occurred in Gardner's Bay, where we haven't seen those blooms before, and in such concentrations that fish have died. We've had fish kills.
So you're saying that these are big picture, greater threats to fish populations than wind power might be when it's being installed?
Well, I think it's definitely a concern. You know, what we're doing to the planet, you know, has an impact on all organisms and ourselves as well. We're all part of this planet.
Well, Peter Van Skoyek, you are Deputy Supervisor of the Town Council of East Hampton. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Sustainable East End.
My pleasure, Francesca. Thanks so much for interviewing me.
You've been listening to Sustainable East End. We heard East Hampton Town's Deputy Supervisor, Peter Van Skoyek. Sustainable East End programs are archived at sustainableeastend.blogspot.com. Information about last night's public forum about the Coastal Assessment Resiliency Plan will be posted there. Sustainable East End is produced by Tony Ernst and yours truly, Francesca Rhiannon.